that had happened to me tonight, but it pretty much fitted in with the way my luck was going. There wasn't a lot I could do about it at the moment, apart from prepare for the ride by not tensing my body up and trying to relax as much as the 3 pairs of Dana boots would allow. The front passenger suddenly bounced around in his seat with a shout of, "What the fuck?" The accent was unmistakably American. "Jesus, Russians!" A split second later, the driver hit the brakes. There was a crash of metal and glass behind us, and the heavy caliber sound of automatic fire. The clear-cut, no-messing New England accent and the sound of rapid fire got me flapping big time. It got worse as our wagon came to a quick, sliding stop, turning sideways on the snow. The doors burst open. "Cover them! Cover them!" The suspension bounced as everyone leaped down from the wagon, using me as a springboard. I suddenly felt very vulnerable, hooded and plastic-cuffed here in the footwell. A vehicle is the natural focus of fire. But I didn't care what was going on and who wanted what from whom. It was time to disappear. Wind whistled through the open doors and the engine was still running. The heavy automatic fire was only about 50 meters away. A series of long, uncontrolled bursts echoed off the trees. This was my opportunity. Pulling up my plastic-cuffed hands, I tried to tug the mask off my face, but the drawstring got stuck on my chin. My fingers were grappling with it when I heard hysterical shouting further down the road. The one advantage of working with Sergei and his gang was that I had learned to recognize some Russian. I might not know what it meant, but I knew where it came from. This had to be the Malaskaya. If I could get the hood off, my plan was to crawl into the driver's seat, then just go for it. As I was struggling with the string, I got a little reminder to keep my head down. Safety glass cracked as a round came through the rear windscreen and hit the headrest above me. At almost the same instant, 2 rounds from the same burst ricocheted off a slab of granite at the roadside and shrieked up into the air. There were more shouts, this time from American voices. "Move! Come on! Let's do it! Let's do it!" My 4x4 wasn't going anywhere, but other engines revved, doors slammed and tires spun uselessly in the snow. At last, I got the mask off. Pulling myself up, I couldn't feel any of my pain, and had just begun to move towards the gap between the seats when I realized it wasn't an option. About 5 meters away, at the side of the track behind a mound of granite, a white-clad figure was pointing an SD at my center mass. I knew because I could see the red splash of his laser sight on my jacket. The black, covered head screamed at me above the nightmare that was happening down the road. "Freeze! Freeze! Down! Down! Down!" Change of plan. With the laser on me, the only problem he had was not missing. There were more screams and shouts mixed with the heavy Russian fire. I got down as flat as possible in the rear footwell. If I could have crawled under the carpet, I would have done. I was feeling even more exposed now I'd seen what was happening behind me. Headlights shone in all directions, illuminating the snowfall as the Americans tried to make their escape around the van that was directly behind our 4x4. It was off to the side of the track, its left wing wrapped around a tree. The driver must still have been in his seat, as I could hear and see the wheels spinning in a frenzied attempt to get back on the gravel. The shadows thrown by the headlights caused even more confusion as bodies moved within the tree line. I saw the muzzle flash of the Russian fire, but coming from way behind the convoy now. They were moving back. My cover must have seen movement in the tree line nearer us. He brought his weapon up and started to fire, putting down a series of rapid, well-aimed 3-round bursts. It sounded pathetic compared with the heavier caliber opposing fire. These weapons were not designed to be used at long range. Even 20 meters was a long way for an SD. "Stoppage!" The boy needed to change mags. I watched as he gripped his outer glove in his teeth, keeping his eyes on me. The moment the glove was off, I saw a white silk touch glove in the headlights. The empty magazine went down the front of his white smock and, producing a new mag from his belt kit, he slapped it into place. He then hit the release catch, which told me these guys were the newer version of the SD. Even more indication that these were official. It was all very slick. I wasn't going to escape just yet. He had a holstered P7, and his weapons drills were so good that even with him under fire, there was no way I'd have time to do anything. I kept my head down and lay still. Wagons screamed past me with skidding wheels. The tree-loving one in the lead, glass smashed and holes in the bodywork, revving far too fast, trying to gain speed. Our vehicle group must have been giving covering fire while they moved out of the danger area. The New England voice was back in earshot. Move on! Move on! Come on! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! The guy covering me got up, still pointing his weapon at me as he moved forward. He jumped into the wagon, ramming his heels down into my back and the weapon into my neck. The barrel was very hot, and I could smell cordite and the oily odour of WD-40. He'd probably smothered it in the stuff to protect it from the weather, and it was now burning off the weapon. The last thing I had a chance to see was him getting hold of the hood, then pulling it back down over my head. All the others were now jumping back in, making the vehicle rock with their weight. I felt the gear shift being engaged, and we started to move off faster than we should, the tires slithering and sliding as we turned back online to move up the track. The doors were slammed shut, and I was hit by a rush of air from above. The electric sunroof was opening. A moment later I heard, click thud, click thud, click thud, and a yell of, get some! Get some! Get some! As New England fired through the open aperture. I couldn't hear any reply from the Russians. One of the others turned and opened fire through the rear window, adding more holes to the safety glass. Click thud, click thud, click thud. Empty cases hit the side window with a metallic ping, 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 then fell and bounced off my head. Freezing cold air blasted through the roof, then the motor whined and the rush of air stopped. Anybody down?
I didn't see anyone.
That came from the rear.
If there is, they'll be in the wagons. No one was left.
I got a heavy slap around the head.
Fucking Russians. Who do you think you are, man?
The front passenger was, without doubt, the commander. His accent sounded as if he should have been standing on an orange box fighting an election for the Democrats in New Hampshire. Not trying to sort out a gangfuck in Finland, but thankfully he seemed to be sorting it out rather well. I was still alive. There was a short pause, maybe while he marshalled his thoughts, then,
Bravo Alpha!
He had to be on the net, listening to his earpiece.
Situation.
There was silence from the others. Well-trained operators know better than to talk when somebody's on the net. The Democrats let out a cry.
Shit! They have Bravo's vehicle!
He got back on the net.
Roger that! Did you total the kit?
There was 5 seconds of silence before he replied in a low, depressed voice.
Roger that, Bravo.
He addressed the vehicle crew.
The sons of bitches have some of the hardware. Shit!
There was no reply from the crew as the Democrat composed himself before getting back on the net.
Charlie, Alpha, situation.
He checked through all his call signs. There seemed to be 4 of them. Bravo, Charlie, Delta, and Echo. How many people at each call sign I didn't know, but there had seemed to be loads of them at the house. It seemed the whole thing had been a gangfuck for everyone. Me getting caught. Tom, well, I didn't know. The Americans and Malaskaya each only getting part of the hardware they wanted. As for the 3 Tom lookalikes from the house, they must be more pissed off than all of us put together. The radio traffic had been in clear speech, which indicated they were using secure and probably satellite comms, not like my Motorola's at the Intercontinental. As they transmit, these radios skip up and down through dozens of different frequencies in a sequence that only radios with the same encryption fill, fluctuating at the same rate and frequency, can hear. Everybody else just gets an earful of mush. He must have got a message from Echo.
Okay. Roger that, Echo, roger that.
He turned towards the bodies in the back.
Bobby has gotten hit in the leg. But everything's fine, it's cool.
There was a sigh of relief from the back. I felt the fabric press against my face as he turned.
Is that asshole still breathing?
My cover answered.
Oh, yeah.
He gave me another dig with his heel and a muttered insult in Texan drawl. I moaned in deep Russian acknowledgement. The commander's arse swiveled again, and my head moved with it. He got back on the net.
All stations, this is Alpha. We're still going as planned. My group will take the extra Paxes. Acknowledge.
I imagined him listening in to the other call signs on his earpiece.
Bravo. Charlie, roger that. Delta, roger. Echo, roger D.
It seemed that I was the extra Paxes. Whatever happened to me now, it would be down to the Democrat. We drove in silence for another 20 minutes, still on the tarmac road. By my estimation, we hadn't gone far. We couldn't have been travelling that fast because of the heavy snow. The Democrats got back on the net.
Papa One, Alpha.
There was a pause while he listened.
Any news yet on Super Six?
More silence.
Then, roger that. I'll wait.
Papa One and Super Six didn't sound like ground call signs. Where possible, these are always short and sharp. It stops confusion when the shit hits the fan or comms are bad, factors which normally go hand in hand. 10 minutes later, the Democrat was back on the net.
Alpha.
He was obviously acknowledging somebody.
There was silence then. Roger that. Super Six call signs are no-go, a no-go.
After a pause of 2 seconds, he announced,
all stations. All stations, okay, here's the deal. Go to the road plan. The extra Paxes still goes with me, acknowledge.
Nothing more came from him as he got the acknowledgement from the other call signs. At least these guys were having a shit day too. The Super Six call signs must have been helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft that couldn't fly in these conditions. In better weather, we would have been flown out of here by people who worked for their firm. 9 out of 10 times, these are civilian pilots with background jobs as commercial flyers. So, they have solid cover stories. They'd fly in on NVGs. Maybe pick us all up, or at least the kit, injured and prisoners, and scream back out of the country to a US base. Or maybe, if they were helis, they'd land on an American warship in the Baltic, where the computer equipment and its operators would be sorted out and moved on to whoever was so keen to have them. If I didn't sort my shit out sooner and escape, I'd land up with them in one of the Americans' reception centres. I'd been shown them in the past. The rooms ranged from cold and wet 3-by-9-foot cells to virtually self-contained suites, depending on what was judged the best way to get information out of Paxes like me. No matter how you looked at it, they were interrogation centres, and it was up to the interrogators, CIA, NSA, whoever they were, whether you got processed the easy way or the hard way. Fuck the pizza boys. I didn't care what happened to them. But now, being one of the Malaskaya, I'd be checking straight into my personal 3-by-9 with corner en suite. There was nothing I could do about that for the time being. I could only hope I'd have a chance to escape before they found out who I really was.
Chapter 24.
We drove quite slowly for about another 20 minutes. It was physically painful lying crammed in the footwell, but that was nothing compared with how depressed I felt about what the future held.
Papa One Alpha, at Blue One.
The Democrat was back on the net. Papa One must be the operating base. The Democrat was counting down to it, sending a report line so that Papa One knew the group's location. A minute or so later, we turned a sharp right.
Papa One Alpha, Blue Two.
I could hear the material on the driver's arms rustling as he worked at the wheel, and the tire noise told me we were still on tarmac and snow. There was a sharp right turn and my head was squeezed against the door. Then we were bumping over what felt like a sleeping policeman, and drove another 30 meters or so before the vehicle came to a halt. The Democrat got out, leaving his door open. As the rear doors opened, other vehicles passed and stopped all around me. The screech of tyres on a dry surface told me we were under cover, and judging by the echoes made by the vehicles, we were somewhere large and cavernous. The three on top of me started to exit. Elsewhere, engines were still running as other doors were pushed or slid open. People clambered out and walked around, but there was no voice noise, only movement. Then came the echoing clatter of steel roller shutters being pulled down manually with chains. Whatever kind of building we were inside, they didn't waste money on heating. Maybe it was an aircraft hangar, which would make sense if we were going to have a pickup with a fixed wing or heli. Then again, maybe it was just an old warehouse. I couldn't see a single glint of light through my mask. The air was becoming heavy with vehicle fumes. As soon as the three pairs of feet had used me as a platform to get out of the wagon, a pair of hands gripped my ankles and started to pull me out, feet first. I was dragged over the door sill and had to put my arms out to protect myself as I dropped the 2 feet or so onto the ground. The dry surface was concrete. There was lots of movement around me, and the same sort of sound as there had been in the house, the shuffling and dragging of electric plugs. The equipment was being moved out of the vans. I heard the telltale clunk of metal on metal as working parts were brought back and weapons unloaded, along with a clicking of the ejected rounds being pressed back into magazines. I was turned over onto my back, and my feet were released and left to drop to the floor. I gave a very Russian moan. 2 pairs of boots walked round to my head. They pulled me up by the armpits and started frog-marching me. My feet dragged along the concrete, toes catching on bumps and potholes, and now and again colliding with a lump of brick or other hard debris. It might have seemed to the two either side of me that I was doing nothing, but at brain cell level, I was really quite busy, trying to take in all the sensory information around me. They dragged me past a wagon, and even through the hood I caught the aroma of coffee, probably them opening the flasks they'd had waiting for them at the end of the job. We passed some subdued sounds of pain and short, sharp breathing. It sounded like a woman. There were men around her.
Okay, let's get another lineup.
It seemed that Bobby in callsign Echo was a woman. They were getting fluids into her and treating her GSW, gunshot wound. We kept moving, my feet dragging through bits of wood, cans and newspapers, theirs occasionally crunching down on plastic drinks cups. I heard the rip of Velcro, then was dragged sideways through a heavy door. They steered me round to the right as the door swung back. The pizza boys were already here. The sound of crying, moans and groans filled what felt like a smaller area than before. The echoes made it sound like we were in a medieval torture chamber, and even in the sanitizing cold this place stank of decay and neglect. A couple more paces and we stopped, and I realized the others were being kicked. That was why they were screaming. I heard boots making contact with bodies and the grunts of the kickers. I was pushed down to the ground, and given a good kicking as well. The moans and sobs seemed to come from my right, and were now somehow muffled one by one. We weren't all in one big room. I guessed we were being put into cupboards or storage spaces. The moment my head banged against the toilet bowl, I knew where I was. A toilet cubicle. Another scream and a grunt echoed as the boys were subdued and persuaded into their new accommodation. I didn't know what was worse, their noise or the fact that the kickers were doing all this without a word, making best use of the echoes to put the shits up everyone. Guided by their kicks, I crawled into the far right corner of the cubicle, coming to rest on what felt like years of debris. The paper I felt was crispy and brittle, like very thin poppadoms. Still getting kicked, I felt a hard brick wall against my back and the base of the toilet pan against my stomach. I kept my head down and knees up in protection, gritting my teeth and waiting for the worst. Instead, my hands were gripped and pulled up into the air, the plastic now tighter against my wrists because they were swelling up. I felt a knife go into the plastic cuffs, and they were cut. Pinioning my left arm over the waste pipe at the rear of the toilet bowl, they grabbed hold of the other arm and shoved it underneath so I had a hand on either side. It was pointless resisting. They had total control over me. There was nothing I could do yet, apart from save my energy. They gripped my wrists together. I tensed up my forearm muscles, trying to bulk them out as much as possible. The plastic cuffs came on, and I heard the ratcheting and felt the pressure as they were tightened. I moaned as soon as it seemed the right thing to do. I wanted to appear as petrified and broken as the pizza boys. They left, slamming the door behind them. I tried resting my head against the pipe, but it was unbearably cold. If there was any water inside, it must be frozen solid. I lay there amongst the rubble and trash, trying to get comfortable, but feeling very aware of the cold floor through my clothing. There was a loud, prolonged creak as the heavy main door into the hangar area swung closed. Then there was silence, even from the pizza boys. Certainly no sounds of dripping plumbing. It was too cold for that. I couldn't hear any of the vehicles either. Nothing but pitch black silence. A couple of seconds later, as if the pizza boys had all been holding their breath, waiting for the bogeymen to go away, the moaning and hooded sobs began once more. After a few moments of that, the boys muttered a few words to each other in Finnish, trying to give each other a boost. They sounded severely scared. I shifted my position in an attempt to get some pressure off my wrists, trying to find out if that extra millimeter or two of muscle flexing had given me any chance of moving my wrists in the plastic cuffs. As I stretched my legs, I connected with what sounded like an empty can. The noise as it rattled and scraped over the concrete gave spark to an idea. I waggled my head past the wastepipe, so that it was resting on top of my hands. Then, feeling with my teeth through the hood, I got hold of my right outer glove. That came off easily enough, and I let it drop to the ground, leaving the touch glove still on my hand. I reached forward with my head, positioning the bottom of the hood over my fingers, and got to work. I now knew the hoods were done up with a drawstring and ties round the bottom, and it wasn't long before it lay on the ground. It seemed a total waste of effort. The cubicle was in complete darkness, and now that I had the hood off, my head was getting cold. My nose started to run almost immediately. Leaning as far forwards as I could to free up my hands, I started to feel around on the ground. My fingers sifted through old paper cups and all sorts of garbage until I found what I wanted. I readjusted my body around the pan to make myself comfortable while I pulled off my other outer glove with my teeth. Then, with both touch gloves still on, I squeezed the thin metal of the drinks can between my thumbs and forefingers until the sides touched in the middle. I then started to bend the two parts backwards and forwards. After only 6 or 7 goes, the thin metal cracked, and soon the two halves were apart. I felt for the ring pull end and dropped the other one next to my gloves and hood. Feeling gently around the broken edge, I looked for a place where I could start to peel the side down like an orange. The sensation had virtually gone in my swollen hands, but the touch glove caught on the aluminium and I found what I wanted, and started to pick and tear. My fingers slipped a couple of times, cutting me on the razor-sharp metal, but there wasn't time to worry about that. Besides, I couldn't feel the pain, and it was nothing to what would be inflicted on me if I didn't get away from here. Once I'd pared the metal down to under an inch from the ring pull end, I tried moving my wrists apart as much as possible. It didn't work that well because plastic cuffs are designed not to stretch, but there was just enough play to do what I wanted. Cupping the can in my right hand with the sharp edge upwards, I bent it towards my wrist, trying to reach the plastic. If I'd left more tin sticking out, it would have gone further, but the edge would have buckled under the pressure. That was also why I used the ring pull end. The thicker rim gave the cutting edge more strength. I knew that establishing a cut into the cuffs was going to take the most time, but once I'd got into that nice, smooth plastic, I could go for it. It must have taken just a minute or two for the jagged tin to finally bite. Then, when I was about 3/4 of the way through, I heard the loud, echoing creak of the swing door opening. Light and engine noise spilled through a gap of about 2 inches under the cubicle door. There was the sound of boots on rubbish heading in my direction. The lights got stronger, and I started to flap big time, dropping the can and scrabbling for the hood, and, once it was on, trying to find my gloves. I didn't manage it, but just as I was gritting my teeth for the inevitable confrontation, the footsteps went past. There was a flurry of muffled pleas in English from the boys as their doors were kicked open and they got dragged out and subdued. They must have heard the Americans during the contact too, as there was no multilingual begging now. Doors banged, and soon I could hear their feet dragging past me. Within moments, the door swung shut and silence was restored. I felt around for the can end, not bothering to take the hood off. I couldn't have seen anything anyway. I started to work with more of a frenzy. I had to assume that they'd be coming for me next, and soon. After 2 or 3 minutes of frantic sawing, the plastic finally gave. Pulling the hood off, I felt around for the gloves and put them in my pocket, keeping just the touch gloves on. Next, I located the other can end. Getting slowly to my feet and enjoying being vertical, I felt around the cubicle. I found the door handle, opened it, and walked very slowly and carefully out into what I could feel was a narrow corridor with painted brick walls. A faint glimmer of light under the swing door trickled into the corridor about 10 feet up on my left. Picking my feet up and putting them down with infinite care, my left hand supporting me on the wall, I made my way towards the light. As I got closer, I began to hear a vehicle engine revving, then starting to move off. Once at the door, I couldn't find a keyhole to look through. So, clearing the debris on the ground, I got down on my knees. Chains rattled as the roller shutter was pulled open. I wondered if the Peter boys were leaving town. Lying flat on the floor on my right side, I managed to get my eyeball close to the bottom of the door. Reaching into my pocket, I pulled out the bottom half of the can, the one I hadn't worked on. Using the light to find a place in the metal where I could start peeling this time. I got to work and put my eye back against the gap. I'd been right. It was some sort of hangar or factory space. It was mostly in darkness, but lit in places by 12-inch-long fluorescent lighting units, the sort that campers use. These had either been perched on the bonnets of wagons or were being carried around. The pools of almost blue light and shadow made the place look like the set of the Twilight Zone. Several vehicles were parked up in a row on the far left, about 40 meters away. Saloons, estates, MPVs and SUVs, some of which had roof racks piled with skis. My thumb slipped and ran along the ripped can. I still couldn't feel it, but at least some sensation was returning to my hands. Pins and needles had started to work their way around my fingers while I carried on peeling the metal back. I looked straight ahead to the exit, my only way out, then at the people who would try and stop me. They were mostly by the 2 remaining vans parked haphazardly in the middle of the hangar. A group of maybe 5 or 6 bodies were hurriedly unloading their weapons and taking off their white uniforms and bundling them into what looked like Lacon boxes. Aluminium air freight containers. They were in a hurry, but not flapping. No one was talking. Everyone seemed to know what was required. When one of the bodies did a half turn so that it was in profile, I realized that Bobby wasn't the only woman on this job. As they continued to throw off their kit, I could now see where the sound of Velcro had come from. She was ripping apart the side straps from sets of body armor before stacking them in the boxes. Another group of maybe 8 were out of their whites and unpacking civilian clothes from holdalls. Others were combing their hair in the wing mirrors, trying to make themselves look like normal citizens. I caught a glimpse of the 4x4 I'd been transported in. Its back window safety glass was pockmarked with holes where the rounds had passed through. Beyond it were the shapes of the other vehicles used on the job, which were now probably going to be abandoned. Strike marks from automatic weapons were not the best kind of modification to be sporting at traffic lights. I couldn't see any evidence of the computer kit. I assumed they'd moved it straight on, along with the pizza boys and probably Bobby and the guy with a hook hanging from his thigh. They'd be in need of proper trauma care. Since the weather had put a stop to a quick exfiltration, the next destination would be a secure area like the US Embassy. From there, the equipment would probably be moved by a diplomatic bag back to the US. Dip bags are basically mail sacks or containers that by mutual agreement other governments cannot have access to. Which means they can contain anything from sensitive documents to weapons, ammunition, and dead bodies. I'd even heard a story of the intelligence service bringing back the turret of a new Russian armored personnel carrier, in what must have been a party-sized one. The pizza boys would be stuck in the embassy or a safe house until a heli could get in sometime tomorrow and airlift them out of the country. Unless there was a US warship in dock. If I didn't get a grip of this situation, I knew I'd soon be following them. Everyone was now out of their whites and in jeans, duvet jackets and hats. The woman was still organizing the loading of the Lacons. Loud, metallic echoes filled the hangar as the boxes were moved into the vans. One man seemed to be running the whole show. I couldn't see his face from this distance, but he was the tallest of the group, maybe 6'2" or 6'3", and a head above everyone else. He gathered everyone around him and seemed to be giving them a brief. They were certainly doing a lot of nodding, but his voice wasn't loud enough for me to understand what he was saying. While he finished the briefing, the doors of the two vans slammed. Both engines revved, and they started to leave. Their headlights swept across the group as they turned towards the shutter. I felt around the rim of the half can in my hands as the chains went into action. I wasn't doing particularly well with it because I hadn't really been concentrating. I watched the Democrats' team disperse as they moved off towards the line of vehicles like aircrew to their fighters, lights swinging in their hands. They were probably going to split up and do their own thing, probably in exactly the same way as they'd come into the country in the first place. They would now be sterile of anything implicating them in the job. They would have cover documents and a perfect cover story, and would certainly no longer be armed. All they had to do was wander back to their chalets and hotels as if they'd had a good night out. Which, I suppose they had. None of them was dead. More engines revved. Doors slammed and headlights came on. I could see the fumes rising from exhausts. It looked a bit like the starting grid before a Grand Prix. The people from the embassy would probably take care of the abandoned vehicles. Their priority was to get away from here now that the equipment and pizza boys were safely on their way. Their only problem was that they had a little bonus. Me. It looked like the Democrats and another woman were taking on that responsibility. The vehicles were now leaving, but they were still on their feet. The woman with a set of jump leads dragging along the floor as she moved out of the way of the holidaymakers. They were leaving nothing to chance. Red brake lights lined up as they took it in turn to exit and hang left. Snow was still falling. I could see it clearly now as full beams shone out into the darkness. Soon, there was just one car left stationary, its engine running and its lights blazing. The Democrat was sitting sideways in the driver's seat with his feet on the concrete, the glow of a cigarette intensifying as he sucked on it. The interior light was on, and I could make out thick curly hair on a very large head. The jump leads were thrown into the rear seat, and the woman disappeared into the darkness. At last, I'd finished the other half of the can. The blood from my fingers felt cold as it was soaked up by my touch gloves. It was a good sign. Feeling had returned to my hands. I was quiet for a few moments, with just the engine ticking over, and then chains started rattling and the shutter closed. The woman emerged from the shadows once again and bent towards the glowing cigarette. I couldn't make out any of her features because her hair covered her face. They talked for a moment. Then he turned back into the car to stub his cigarette in the ashtray. He was clearly too professional even to leave DNA evidence on the floor. By then, she was round the back, pulling open the boot. The Democrat started walking in my direction. his long legs silhouetted by the vehicle's headlamps. There was a flicker of bright, white light, then the fluorescent unit in his left hand burst into life. I could see that he'd just finished pulling his balaclava back on. I watched his right hand go under his coat and come out again holding a multi-barreled P7, which went into his coat pocket. My body banged into shock. He was coming to kill me. I made myself calm down. Of course he wasn't coming to kill me. Why would they have gone to the trouble of bringing me here? And why the hood to hide his identity? He was taking precautions in case I'd pulled my hood off. The car edged forward with the boot open as he got within about 10 meters of the door, the light still swaying in his left hand. It was time to get in gear. Otherwise, I'd soon be given a dose of the medicine I'd forced Val to take last week. I got to my feet and moved to the right of the door, away from the toilets, flapping at the prospect of taking on a guy of his size. All that stuff about the bigger they are, the harder they fall. It's a myth. The bigger they are, the harder they hit you back. I wasn't sure how long the corridor was, but I soon found out. I'd only taken 4 steps when I banged into the end wall. Turning back, I faced the door, fumbling in my pocket for the other half can, breathing deeply to oxygenate myself in preparation. The door swung open with a metallic screech of its hinges, momentarily flooding the area with bright, white light. I could hear the car whining in reverse. He had turned right, his massive back to me now, as he took the first few steps towards my toilet cubicle. I moved quickly as the door closed, not exactly running, because I didn't want to trip over, but taking long, fast steps to get some speed and momentum, with my right arm raised. With the main door closed and car engine running, there was no way she was going to hear this. He did, though, and when I was still a couple of meters away, he started to turn. I focused on the shape of his head as I leaped up and at him. Landing with my left foot forward, I swung my whole body to the left, my right arm crooked and the palm held open. Sometimes a really firm, heavy slap to the face can be more effective than a punch, and that's absolutely guaranteed if you're wielding a sawn-off drinks can with razor-sharp edges. I hit his head hard. I didn't care where the can connected, just so long as it did. There was a loud groan. I didn't feel the can digging in, just the pressure of my arm being stopped mid-swing as the rest of my body carried on swiveling. The light danced as the fluorescent unit in his hand clattered to the concrete, and he started to follow it. I swung to the right with my left arm slightly bent, still focusing on his head. I hit the mark. I could feel the softness of his cheek under the left half of the can, then felt it scrape around the contour of his jaw as he fell. He moaned again, this time louder and with more anguish. By now he was on his knees. As I brought my right hand down hard onto the top of his head, the metal edges dug deep, then hit bone, stripping back the skin as he fell. I gouged a thick furrow from his scalp. The can held for a couple more inches and then broke free. He slumped to the ground, hands scrabbling to protect his head. For a few more frenzied seconds, I continued to slash at his hands and head. Then his hands fell away and he lay very still. He wasn't feigning unconsciousness. He wouldn't have risked dropping his hands and exposing himself to further attack. He had gone into shock, but he was still breathing. He wasn't dead. He was never going to get a job modeling for Gillette, but he'd live. There had been no other way out. If you're going to stop somebody, you have to do it as quickly and violently as you can. The fluorescent unit threw a pool of light across the floor and onto his balaclava. The wool still looked remarkably intact, as it does when a sweater rips and the tear seems to knit itself together, unless you look at it close up. Blood was seeping through the material. Dropping the cans, I rolled him over onto his back and, putting my knee into his face just to make things worse, I pulled out the P7 and a mobile that was also in there. That went into my pocket. My breathing was now very fast and shallow, and just slightly louder than the engine ticking over immediately beyond the swing door. I could see the red glow from the taillights under the door gap, and my nose was filling with exhaust fumes. Getting to my feet, I got hold of the top of his balaclava and pulled it off. At last, I saw the extent of the damage. He had some severe gouges where the can had gone right through his cheeks, and flaps of skin hung across his mouth. In places, I could see bone through the blood-soaked, hairy mess of his skull. I pulled the mask over my head, trying to cut down on the chances of being recognized later. It was wet and warm. I checked his body for a radio as he whined weakly to himself. There was nothing. He'd have been planning to be sterile like the rest of them. He'd had to hang on to the P7 to sort me out. I turned towards the door. It was the woman's turn next. Pushing through, I moved into a cloud of red fumes and brake lights. The vehicle was no more than 3 feet away, engine idling, boot still open and waiting for me. I moved straight to the left-hand side as the swing door banged shut behind me. Bringing the pistol up into the aim, I pointed it at the woman's face, the muzzle a foot from the glass. If she opened the door, she couldn't knock the pistol out of line quickly enough to do anything about it. If she tried to drive forward, she would die first round. She stared, wide-eyed at the barrel from under her multicolored ski hat. In the glow from the instrument panel, I could see her trying to make sense of what her eyes were telling her. It wouldn't take her long. My blood-soaked touch gloves and the Democrat's mask would soon give her a clue. With my left hand, I motioned for her to get out. I was supposed to be Russian. I wasn't going to open my mouth unless I had to. She kept staring, transfixed. She was bluffing. She'd drop me at the first opportunity. Moving further back as the door inched open, I decided to put on a heavy Slavic accent. Well, what I thought sounded like one.
Gone! Gone!
She stared up at me with frightened eyes and said, in a little girl voice,
Please don't hurt me. Please don't hurt me.
Then she opened her legs to show me a P7 nestled between her jeaned thighs. They were definitely traveling sterile, otherwise they would have had conventional weapons for this phase. I motioned for her to drop it in the footwell. She moved her hand very slowly downwards to comply. The moment she dropped it, I moved in, grabbing her by her shoulder-length dark brown hair and heaving her out of the car and onto all fours. With the P7 jammed into her neck, I felt for a mobile. It seemed I had the only one. Moving back 3 paces, I pointed at the far wall, where the car had originally been parked, and she got up and started walking. I didn't care what she did now that she was disarmed. All their radios would have been stashed. I had the mobile, and there was no one left that she could turn to for help. I got into the warm car, a Ford, threw it into first gear and screamed towards the closed shutter. She was probably in the corridor by now to find out what had happened to her friend, the Democrat. Stopping alongside the four vans and the shot-out 4x4, I got out with a P7 in hand and splashed through the small puddles made by melting snow from the vehicles, ready to shoot out some tires. You don't just go up and fire straight at rubber. There's too high a chance of the round ricocheting back. You use the engine block to protect you. Lean round the wing and then do it. The P7's signature thud was nothing to the high-pitched ding that echoed round the hangar as the round hit metal. Then there was a hiss as air escaped under pressure. I took a look behind me. There was nothing happening from the corridor yet. Once all vehicles were taken care of, I jumped back into the driver's seat and aimed for the shutters, though this time in reverse, so the headlights were pointed at the swing door. If she came for me, I wanted to see. I braked, threw the gearbox into neutral and leaped out. The ice-cold metal chains burned my hands, even through the touch gloves as I pulled down in a frenzy to open the shutters. Raising them just enough to get the car out, I clambered back in and reversed out into the snowfall, pointing the vehicle in the direction everyone else had gone. I left the hangar behind, not knowing whether to feel sorry for the Democrat, relieved at still being alive, or angry with Val and Liv. I checked the fuel tank. It was nearly full, as I would have expected. The mobile went out the window and buried itself in the snow. No way was such a fantastic tracking device going to stay with me. The snow was falling heavily. I didn't have a clue where I was, but that didn't really matter as long as I got away. Pulling at the mask, I felt the Democrat's blood smear across my face. It finally came off, and I threw it into the footwell along with the other P7. Hitting the interior light, I took a look in the mirror. There was so much red stuff on me, I looked like a beetroot. There was no way I could drive after first light or in a built-up area looking like this. The steering wheel, too, was smeared with blood from the touch gloves. I'd have to sort myself out. After maybe an hour, I pulled off the road and had a quick wash in the freezing snow. Then, with a cleaned-up body and car and the blood-soaked gear buried in a snowdrift, I drove through the night, looking for signs that would steer me to Helsinki. The more I thought about it, the more severely pissed off I became. Whether Liv and Val knew about the Americans wanting to join in the fun, I wasn't sure, but I intended to find out. Chapter 25. Wednesday, 15th of December, 1999. I sat on the floor next to a radiator in the corner of the station, facing the row of telephone booths that displayed the DLB loaded sign. The black marker stripe down the side of the right-hand booth was clearly visible from the bus station doors immediately to my right. I had a copy of the International Telegraph, an empty coffee cup, and, in my right pocket, a P7 with a full 7-round unit. Detached from its pistol grip in my left-hand pocket was the other unit, containing 3 remaining rounds. As soon as the shops opened that morning, I'd bought a complete set of clothes to replace the cold, wet ones I was wearing. I was now in a dark beige ski jacket, gloves, and a blue fleece-pointed hat. I didn't care if I looked a numpty. It covered up my head and most of my face. My pulled-up jacket collar did the rest. Pain lanced across my left shoulder as I adjusted my position. The bruising probably looked horrendous. There was nothing I could do about it but moan to myself and be thankful I hadn't fallen on anything sharp. I'd dumped the car off at a suburban railway station just after 8 o'clock that morning and trained into the city. The snow was still falling, so the vehicle would be covered by now and the plates would be uncheckable. On arrival at Helsinki, I'd pulled off the left luggage ticket from under locker number 11 and collected my bag, cash, passports and credit cards. I also checked for Tom's ticket under number 10. It was still wrapped in its plastic and taped under the locker. I'd been thinking about him a lot. If the Americans or the Malaskaya hadn't killed him last night, the weather would have. Tom had skills, but playing at Grizzly Adams wasn't one of them. I felt pissed off, but not too sure if that was for him or me. It was then that I wrote him off. There has to be a stage when that happens, so your mind can be free to concentrate on more important things, and I wasn't short of those. I left his bag ticket where it was. It would be an emergency supply of money and a new passport, once I'd tampered with it, in case what I was about to do went a rat shit. Despite my best efforts, I found I couldn't help feeling sorry for Tom as I sat and watched a constant flow of travellers moving through the doors. It was my lies and promises that had got him where he was now, face down in the snow, or bundled up somewhere in an American body bag. The thing that made me feel even guiltier was that I knew I was just as pissed off about not making any money as I was about his death. Cutting away from that, I buried my hands deeper into my pockets, wrapping them round the P7 barrels. I was getting even more annoyed because I'd dumped the bag and blanket that could now be keeping my arse warm and comfortable, and because I knew that Tom's death would become yet another of those niggling little glitches that would surface in the hours before first light while I tried to sleep. The station was packed. Father Christmas had already done 2 circuits, collecting money for neglected reindeer or whatever. People had been dragging in the snowfall on their footwear and, thanks to the large Victorian-style radiators, puddles had formed around the door area and gradually spread further into the station. I looked at Baby G. It was 14:17, and I'd been here over 4 hours already. I was gagging for another brew, but needed to keep a trigger on the doors. Besides, once I drank, I would inevitably need the toilet at some stage. and I couldn't afford to miss Liv when and if she arrived. It was going to be a long food and coffee-free day, and maybe night. From the point of view of third-party awareness, it's not too bad hanging around a railway station. You can get away with it for quite a long time. I adjusted my numb, cold arse again, deciding not to waste time speculating about what the fuck had happened at the Microsoft house. The facts were, I had made no money. Tom was dead, and I could be in a world of shit with the Americans and a universe of shit with the firm. If my involvement was discovered, I'd end up helping to prop up a flyover in a concrete pillar somewhere along the new Eurotunnel high-speed link. I'd never been too worried about dying, but to be killed by my own people would be a bit depressing. The longer I'd thought about what had happened on the drive last night, the more I'd boiled over with hostility towards Liv and Val. I had to come up with a plan that still got me what I needed and not waste time and energy trying to work out how to get even. Apart from anything else, that wouldn't pay any clinic bills. Plan B was taking shape in my head. The Malaskaya's money would pay for Kelly when I lifted Val and offered him to them for cash. My life had been up for grabs for years, and for a lot less money. I had no idea how I was going to do it yet. I'd have to hit the ground running. But the first phase would be to let Liv think I had the ThinkPad with the downloaded information on it, and, because of last night's fuck-up, I'd only deal with Val now, and only in Finland. Who knows? If Val turned up with the money, I could just take that and save myself the hassle. But that wasn't the message I'd left in the plastic box I'd placed in the DLB. It was empty, just there so that when she came to get it, there was something to unload, so as not to arouse suspicion. Everything needed to be as it should be. As she left the station, I would grab her and tell her in person, so she made no mistake about what I wanted. I'd been sitting there for another 20 minutes when a large group of school kids on an excursion tried to get through the bus station doors all at once, juggling bags, skis, and Big Macs as they tried to walk, talk, and listen to Walkmans at the same time. Less than 30 seconds later, I saw Liv come through and walk straight past the loaded sign without even turning her head. But I knew she would have seen it. Her long black coat, Tibetan hat and light brown boots were easy to spot among the crowd as she moved through the hall, brushing snow from a shoulder with one hand and carrying two large paper Stockman bags in the other. She carried on past the kiosks and toilets, manoeuvring through the school kids, who were now waiting for one of their teachers to sort his shit out with the tickets. I kept my eye on the peak of Liv's hat. I had a good check to make sure she hadn't been followed in, just in case she'd brought any protection with her, or worse, in case the Democrat had a few of the party faithful on her tail. The hat disappeared as she turned left into the ticketing and metro hallway. There was no rush. I knew where she was heading. Once on my feet and past the school trip, I pinged her again, just about to sit on top of the DLB, next to some more kids. The busker was in his normal spot, knocking out some old Finn favourite on his accordion. The noise mixed nicely with the rumpus from a group of drunks on the other side of the benches. They were having an argument with Father Christmas, much to the amusement of those passing. Liv sat down as Santa poked the chest of one of the drunks. Staff began to step in to separate them. I watched Liv bend down and pretend to mess around with her bags. Her hand moved to pick up the DLB. The empty container was pulled from the Velcro and dropped into one of the bags. It wouldn't get read here. I waited for her to leave, positioning myself in a corner so that whatever door she decided to head for, I wouldn't be in her line of sight. A few minutes passed before she stood up, looking towards the ticketing area and smiling broadly. Her arms went out as the man from St. Petersburg emerged, smiling, from the crowd. They embraced and kissed, then sat down together, talking in that smiley, hand-in-hand, nice-to-see-you way, their noses only inches apart. He was dressed in the same long camel-hair coat, this time with a dark maroon polo neck sticking out of the top. Today he also carried a light brown leather briefcase. Making sure I wasn't in line of sight of the platform doors, I checked the departures and arrivals board high on the wall. The St. Petersburg train, going on to Moscow, was leaving from Platform 8 at 15:34, just over half an hour's time. They talked for another 10 minutes, and then both stood up. Liv's contact picked up her bags in one hand, his briefcase in another, and they walked towards the platform doors. Alarm bells started to ring in my head. Why had he picked up her bags? My heart started to pound even harder when they both went through the doors and out onto the snow-covered platform. Shit. Was she going with him? Maybe the courier had just given her the news about what had happened at Microsoft HQ, and Liv was bailing out while she could. I counted to 10, and pushed my way out into the cold. Platform 8 was to the right of me as I headed towards the left luggage area. The snow was falling gently, and there wasn't a breath of wind. I walked with my head down, hands in pockets. Glancing sideways across the tracks, I saw they were heading for the carriages about midway along the train. I walked slowly towards the left luggage room, watching until they got on board. Then, checking my watch as if I'd just remembered something, I turned on my heels. There were about 17 minutes to go before they left for St. Petersburg, and it looked like I'd have to go with them. I went past two of the Russian train staff, standing in the guards van at the rear of the train, their high-peaked, Nazi officer-style caps pushed onto the backs of their heads as they glumly took a swig of whatever was in their bottle. I climbed aboard and entered a clean, though very old, carriage, with a corridor facing the platform and compartments all the way along to my right. I moved along the warm walkway and sat down on one of the hard, fabric-covered seats in the first empty compartment. The strong, almost scented cigarette smell probably never left these trains. What now? I had money but no visa. How was I going to cross into Russia? Hiding in the toilets only works in Agatha Christie movies. Maybe a bribe could get me in. I'd play the dickhead tourist.